Thank you, Mr. Bishoner. Thanks to the work of many French, German, and British archaeologists going back to the 18th and 19th centuries, today we have a wealth of knowledge about the ancient kingdoms and dynasties of the nation of Egypt. In our age, it's very difficult to fathom how powerful and how great the kingdom of Egypt was, because it's nothing like that now. It's certainly not a prominent nation on the world scene. And in our own doctrines and theology and in study of prophecy, we focus a lot on the four major world ruling kingdoms that came into being about the time of Judah going into captivity, and before that, Israel going into captivity. We've studied extensively for many, many years on the kingdoms of Babylon and Persia and Greece and Rome. But when you consider the influence of the ancient nation of Egypt, it was probably more powerful in its day and at its height than any of those kingdoms. Egypt is a very important and powerful symbol, even in our modern age, for Christians, as a matter of fact. What are some of the lessons from this ancient society for us? Because as we enter, in just a couple of weeks, the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, we'll once again be going back into ancient times and looking at the nation of Egypt and some of the symbols and some of the metaphors of that kingdom and that nation. It's not an impressive nation today. As I said, it's 100 million people, or just shy of 100 million people. And it's not really even anywhere near a world leader. It's probably a leader among the Middle Eastern nations, probably the most powerful of all of the Middle Eastern nations, all of the Arab nations. It's an Arab republic. But certainly it's going to have its space and its place in Bible prophecy in the near future and the faraway future and the time of the millennium. But sometimes it's hard for us to imagine the accomplishments of that nation going back 4,000 years. And it's kind of hard to look at the nation today and its relative lack of influence and imagine how it could have been so impressive and so powerful and so compelling as a nation in ancient times. But the ancient accomplishments of the Egyptians, even today, sometimes baffle our modern engineering, our architecture, our science, and mathematics. It was an area that was far advanced for its time, and its influence in many, many areas spread to all the known world. They were the first civilization to develop cement. And the basic components of cement haven't really changed. Look how important that is even in the industrialized world. Something as simple as that. They were probably the first society, archaeologists believe, to develop lakes as reservoirs. And of course, that's a very important thing even in the modern age. They were the group of people that discovered and developed something that sometimes is disparaged. I'm not exactly sure why, because it's certainly founded on logic, but they invented the scientific method, that is, developing a hypothesis and then testing that hypothesis through examination and trial to see whether it is true. They had a decimal system. Now, they were the first of beekeepers. So anybody interested in beekeeping? Conrad's not here, so hi, if Conrad's watching, Conrad Lewis, one of our members that lives in North Carolina now, but he was a beekeeper. They developed glassworks. They were able, as you know, they were able to carve granite and make it smooth. Probably took a lot of manpower, probably took a lot of people, but they did it. They may have even developed batteries for storing electricity. That's kind of an unknown. It may be a reach, but some people think that. They were skilled in terms of medical surgery. They had dentists. They had even brain surgeons. I'm not sure that it was all that advanced, but they did operate. And the medical records from ancient times, ancient Egypt, indicate that they had developed a system of examination, diagnosis, treatment, and prognosis. And by the 19th dynasty, I guess I can even thank the ancient Egyptians for this now that I've just recently retired, but they had a sophisticated system of medical insurance, believe it or not. We can't always blame it on FDR, can we? They had pension plans and even sick leave, so I don't suppose that held true when it comes to Israel being enslaved in their midst, but among the populace they did. So Egypt remains a very powerful symbol, and especially as we approach the days of unleavened bread, because even after its fall as an empire in the ancient world, Egypt figured prominently in the Bible record. You may note Revelation chapter 11 and verse 8, that Egypt, even in prophecy, is mentioned as a symbol. And you don't have to turn there, but if you want to, I'll read this verse. It speaks of the two witnesses and associates Egypt at that time with something very evil. It says, their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt. And so Sodom, probably one of the most powerful symbols for evil and wrongdoing, and Egypt are kind of lumped together. So the two witnesses are laid in state, so to speak. And in Jerusalem, which is associated here with Sodom and Egypt, where our Lord also was crucified. So Egypt is, well, Egypt and Jerusalem is in the future coupled together with the most depraved of all societies that the Bible records. Now, Egypt is mentioned many hundreds of times throughout the Bible, as you know, and we know that it figures significantly in the formation and the history of ancient Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel. But let's take a look at what the future holds for Israel, as we are for Egypt. In Bible prophecy, after Christ's return, it shows that, and I always think of this as in Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 17, I always think of this as one of those prophecies that could come to pass, doesn't necessarily have to come to pass, but it's showing what will happen if people aren't obedient. And in this sense, Egypt is shown to be a potential symbol of disobedience. And we won't know until the time comes whether or not this prophecy comes to pass. It's what you might call a conditional prophecy, that if they do that, then God's going to do what he says. It shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They will receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So it's conditional. We don't know yet if they will or won't. But God promises that if they won't, they're going to have plagues. They're not going to have rain. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Egypt figures to be prominent in the world once again. Even though it's not a nation of great prominence in this day and age, it's mentioned along with Assyria and Israel as being very prominent nations during the 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ. Turn to the book of Hebrews in chapter 11. In verse 23, there's this very powerful symbol and this story in the faith chapter in Hebrews 11. It says something about something all of us can understand and experience, as a matter of fact. Despite the fact that it's an ancient lesson, the lessons ring true in today's age as well for people of faith. In Hebrews 11, in verse 23, it says, By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer the affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. So Egypt is not only pictured as a type of sin in the book of Hebrews, where Moses forsook the pleasures of sin for a season, but the epitome as a society of sinful life. Now let's go back to the book of Genesis, because this nation was prominent for a very long time, and even shortly after the flood became a powerful nation, and God's people came into contact with it very early on. In Genesis chapter 12, you know, the Bible does not shield its heroes from their bad examples, and in this case, Abram, whose name was later changed to Abraham, is mentioned. And Egypt becomes a symbol of something that we are very, very familiar with. In Genesis chapter 12 and verse 10, "Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, 'Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore it will happen, when the Egyptians see you, they will say, "This is his wife," and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say, "You're my sister," that it may be well with me for your sake, that I may live because of you." Well, Abram had jumped to the conclusion, which later proved to be incorrect, but, or at least as far as we know, but she obeyed him. She did what he told her to do. So it was, when Abram came into Egypt, that the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commanded her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. Not the kind of life that we live today, not the kind of society, but shows the power of the Pharaoh. He treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys and camels. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife?" And we're not told how it is that the Pharaoh understood that God was intervening in the situation, but it's pretty clear that he did know that there was something wrong and that God was responsible for it. We're not told exactly what he understood about God, but he understood that there were some bad things happening in his household, and it was because he had taken another man's wife into his household. "Why did you say she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife." Now, she's probably taken into the court to be prepared to be a wife of the Pharaoh. Didn't consummate in that direction. "Now, therefore, here's your wife, take her and go your way." So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Well, Abraham wasn't finished with Egypt just yet, but we can see the lesson here is, it's not a problem of Egypt necessarily, but we see the lesson of compromising with what you know to be valid, to what you know to be true, and that's a lesson that people have to learn all the time. In Genesis chapter 16, Genesis 16 and verse 3, Mr. Scriber from Phoenix gave excellent sermon about this last year, so I won't go into the details. You can look it up and listen to Mr. Randy Scriber's sermon on this message, but on this point. But in Genesis 16 and verse 3, then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. And after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So Abram, called elsewhere in the Bible the father of the faithful, had a problem with compromising with things that he knew to be right. And Sarah, too. They had difficulties with this. And it just so happened to involve an Egyptian woman, Hagar. Now, Egypt, in Genesis, have you turn to Genesis chapter 26 as well. Genesis chapter 26 and verse 1. There was a famine in the land, besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Then the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land which I shall tell you." So even prior to the time of the nations and the tribes of Israel, Egypt would have been a natural magnet for God's people, apparently. A natural choice for them to go. God prevented it from happening, but it had the tremendous resource of the Nile River, one of the world's great rivers. It had water, it had agriculture, it had a developed society. It had many of the things that would be appealing. God said, "Dwell," verse 3, "in this land, and I will be with you and bless you, for to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham and your father." Obviously, if he'd gone down to Egypt, he may not have ever been able to inherit the blessings and all the land that God intended him. Egypt could have been a place Egypt could have been a place where Isaac could have been sidetracked. So powerful were its lures and its problems. And Abraham certainly succumbed to personal weakness in his relationships with the early Egyptian royalty, and Isaac was warned not to go there. Jacob was later taken to Egypt in his old age, and Joseph stayed in the country, saved the country from famine, and all Israel was, of course, incubated within this nation. Turn to the book of Genesis in chapter 39. There are some good examples from God's people in terms of dealing with Egypt. And in this case, we know the story of Joseph being sold into slavery and sold into the hand of Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh. In verse 1, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. He was blessed by God. He was obedient to God. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. So it was from that time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had had in his house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hands, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph and said," that's pretty direct, "lie with me." And we know the story. We know how powerful temptation and seduction can be. And yet, of course, Joseph was the individual who, in a very, very positive way, resisted it and still ended up being punished, as we know, going into prison. Now, God made lemonade out of all of these lemons, as we know. But I think I mentioned this example before. Sometimes when you don't compromise, it can at least initially get you into trouble a little bit. I had, I don't know if my brother Hugh is watching, but I'll recount this example from brother Hugh, who was working for a company in Maryland years ago, and of course been a church member for many years by that time. But I hope I'll get the story straight, Hugh, if you're watching today. But he was responsible for the inventory in one of their warehouses, and they had some water damage from flooding or from rain or whatever, you know. And there was a building in which there was no water damage, but his supervisor wanted him to tell the insurance company that the inventory within that building, which hadn't been damaged by rain or flooding or leaking roofs or whatever it was damaged, and he wouldn't do it. And so he was fired. Well, you know, bad situation. He didn't compromise with what he knew to be true and right, but he lost his job as a result. Well, eventually, a couple weeks later, he got an even better job with more money. And then about 6 months after that, the job that he was fired from, the company went out of business, went bankrupt. So, you know, it never hurts to do the right thing. Although apparently Egypt was never as strong a nation after the Exodus, probably floundered for a while, it still figured as an important nation for thousands of years after that. In Matthew chapter 2, there were some apparently positive aspects about this nation, at least during the time of Christ. In Matthew chapter 2 and verse 13, under the right circumstances, if God tells you to do something, even go to Egypt, then I suppose you do it. Now, when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word. For Herod will seek the young child to destroy him." And when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt. And he was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, "Out of Egypt I called my son." So in this case, Egypt was a protective harbor for the Christ child. Now, if you have read, and I'm sure you have extensively in the book of Exodus, you'll see the many, many dozens of references to Israel being delivered from Egypt, Israel being enslaved from Egypt, and ironically, they were a people that had been saved by Israel. Then they later on came to be enslaved by the Egyptians. And that's probably one of the more powerful symbols from ancient Egypt. That is that slavery can be, if it's gradual, which it was in the case of the Israelites coming into slavery, if it's gradually, it can be both overt in the sense that it's day-to-day, it's dramatic, and as you read through the first 12 chapters of Exodus, you find that the people of Israel were enslaved. It was a bad slavery, and they had taskmasters, and they were put to work, forced labor, and it was a horrible situation, but also kind of subtle in a way, because sometimes when things ease up, people forget how bad things really were. In Exodus chapter 14, Israel is left Egypt in their in the dust of their footprints leaving, and Pharaoh drew near. In Exodus chapter 14 and verse 10, sometimes people forget, or sometimes all of us can forget the condition of our lives, in this case, prior to our calling, or what might have happened to us had we never been called to God's way. Exodus chapter 14 and verse 10, "And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, 'Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness?'" Pretty harsh. horrible, horrible thing to say in a moment of pressure. They had forgotten, you know, at least momentarily, all of the horrible things that happened to them while they were enslaved by that nation. Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? You know, they were saying at that time, in that moment of crisis, we actually want to be the servants of sin, because Egypt is a type of sin in the Bible, as Hebrews brings out. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And obviously this has its modern counterpart, even in today's age, even in our own experience, knowing people of faith, knowing people who have relegated their faith to the ash heap of history, so to speak. But was this true? If they had said this before to Moses, there really isn't any record of it. So I guess we don't know. Did they really tell him they wanted to stay and serve the Egyptians? I don't think so, but I don't know. Maybe there were some people that were reluctant. And of course, they had plundered the Egyptians. They had taken away some of the fabulous wealth of that land and that great nation. And there wasn't apparently any complaining at that time just before they left. In Exodus chapter 16 and verse 2, then the whole congregation, another instance after they were delivered from this and they went through the Red Sea, of course, that wasn't the end of their complaining, obviously. Then the whole congregation of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and we ate bread to the full. There's really no record of that. In the first 12 chapters of Exodus, there's no record of this luxurious life that is being depicted in their crying and in their complaining. And when we ate bread to the full, you know, most of the time people in slavery don't really eat to the full, but I guess your imagination can run wild. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. Now, there are many examples of their complaints and their problems and the difficulties that Moses had. In Exodus chapter 17, in verse 2, people contended with Moses once again. They contended and said, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it that you've brought us up out of the land of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. Of course, looking back retrospectively, our part, we can see the examples. We can see these people. They had been delivered time and time again. But the day-to-day and the problems of the day-to-day are probably very similar to the ones that we have in our modern society. Moses and the people of Israel had been delivered. They had been tested. And, of course, we know from 1 Corinthians 10, that all of these examples are for our benefit. They're for our benefit today, because the problems of sin, the problems of compromise, the problems of personal weakness like Abram had, the problems of being enslaved to sin hit all of us. And sometimes it's easy for any of us to forget our own deliverance. And one of the main reasons we go through these lessons year by year is to remember where we were and where we are. Israel didn't have, or at least at that time, these people did not have access to the Holy Spirit of God that would enable them to make that comparison, enable them to adjudicate their situation in a way that would make sense. A few did, obviously. In the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, And there will be times in our lives in which we will have to remain true and constant to this particular encouragement that is given to the Bible. All of these examples are given for our benefit because their problems are similar to our problems. Human nature, the problems of our world, the problems of our society do not change in all reality. The circumstances, we live in a more modern age, a more modern world, greater conveniences and everything else. But all of the things that have been mentioned in conjunction with Egypt, compromising, sin, personal weakness, they're all the same things that we have today. And we have to battle them just as these folks did. In verse 13 it says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man." That means that with ancient Israel and, you know, even with the ancient Egyptians, we have that same human nature that they did. And there really aren't any problems that are new or different that Christians have to face than these ancient folks faced. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. And that's a promise from God. So God can deliver us from any problem, any difficulty, any society, any temptation that we come up against. Turn to the book of 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. The judgment of God is constant, and that's one of the points that Peter is making in this particular example. Kind of breaking into the thought here. But it says, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example of those who afterward who would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot." That's kind of encouraging of and by itself. Lot is not shown in the greatest light in the example of Sodom and Gomorrah when he has to be actually taken out by angels and taken out of that city and kind of leaving reluctantly, and then some of the subsequent problems that he had after that time, and you can remember that and research that once again for yourself. But Lot, a man that we could see obviously had problems and had sin, is called just Lot, righteous Lot. As long as there's life, there's hope, right? People can repent. People can change. Lot changed. Lot became righteous. "And delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man, dwelling among them, tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment." So God provides a way of escape for problems and temptations, and he also powerfully delivers when you need it. You have to claim that promise. Deliverance from temptations is really a piece of cake for God. Now, in Exodus chapter 32, everyone remembers this scene, I'm sure, from the, if you've seen the movie, The Ten Commandments, not an endorsement or anything. But everybody remembers this scene. How accurate the depiction in the movie is, I'm not really sure. But maybe it captures some of the essence when Moses comes down off the mount with the Ten Commandments. In Exodus 32, in verse 1, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, 'Come, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.' And Aaron said to them, 'Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me.' So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf." They had obviously learned something in this advanced state of Egypt. They had learned how to smelt metal, melt it all down, and then cast it into this figure, a golden calf. Then they said, and that's a complex process. I don't know if they used the process known as the last lost wax process for casting. They could have, but it's a somewhat sophisticated process for making molds and using wax. I won't go into all the details of it, but it's pretty complex for the time. So obviously they had learned that in Egypt. "O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." So when Aaron, verse 5, saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and to rose up to play. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves." So everybody is writhing, dancing. It's depicted in the movie, The Ten Commandments, a golden calf, all continuing in this way. Peer pressure, compromise, go hand in hand. Aaron succumbed to it. And apparently he got his life straightened around later on as well, but people can succumb to peer pressure and compromise, and he knew better. The point is, they had come out of Egypt, but they still had a lot of Egypt left in all of them. Now, Aaron recovered from his mistake, but his name is there for everybody to see, and the problems that he had. He compromised. I told you the story about we were recounting this several weeks ago in somebody's home, but there was the famous sculptor who worked on Mount Rushmore. His name was Korchak Joukowsky, and he didn't get along well with the man that ran the project, Gutzon Borglum, who was the one that was commissioned to carve the monument at Mount Rushmore. So he got kicked off the project, but he stayed in the area of South Dakota. He was from New Haven, Connecticut. And when I met him, he was in his 80s. He's a pretty powerful and strong man in his 80s. And Terry and I got to know his wife, Ruth, who was quite a bit younger than he was, and she was very helpful to the Church of God and the people that came to Crazy Horse Monument to see the Crazy Horse Monument, which is still going on today. And the stories in those days, the news reports in those days, I had read before our meeting, and I'd noticed that the federal government offered him the sum of $10 million back in the late 70s or early 80s in order for him to finish that project, but you know they would take it over as a national park or whatever. But he refused the money, and I said, "Why did you refuse that money? Because here you are charging $5 a carload for people to come in to see what you're doing," and he had a museum as well, which was, you know, $5 a carload was a bargain for everything that you could see what this man had done. And I said, "Was it because you thought you'd have to compromise your values?" And he looked at me and he said something that almost scared me. It was so true. He was gruff and he was tough and he was a little gravelly and he was kind of a hard-bitten pioneer type. And he looked at me and he said, compromise is the language of the devil. I was 26 years old at the time. He was right. I knew he was right. But he had learned that lesson. And compromise was one of the problems of Egypt and the people that have come in contact. So we've had a brief review of Egypt. It's a metaphor in the Bible for sin, for slavery, for compromise, and succumbing to personal weakness. But there's one thing I'd like to leave you with, and that is a positive example. You know, we leave the days of unleavened bread, and we have put on unleavened through that time. We talk about the symbols of leaven being malice and wickedness. We talk about unleavened being a symbol of righteousness. And we often leave with the encouragement from the days of unleavened bread to go out and continue in that unsinful way, to go in the way of righteousness. There's really nothing that prevents us from going into the days of unleavened bread with that encouragement to begin with. And so that's what I intended to leave you with. We read in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 8 this: "Therefore let us keep the feast not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." I know a lot of times I've finished off the days of unleavened bread. That might be the last scripture I'll read in a sermon on the last day of unleavened bread. And maybe it's one of the ones that I'll read at the first of the days of unleavened bread as well. But today, I wanted to lay a special kind of burden on you in a positive way, on you as an individual. A few years ago, I was at a company meeting, and this was a large meeting. It was a national meeting, probably 700 or 800 people with my company. And as companies are wont to do at times, they bring in a motivational speaker from outside the company to speak to your group. And the guy they chose for this meeting was probably the best of any outside speaker that I've ever heard, because when you think about people that have overcome all odds, this guy would be the one that would fit the bill. When you think about somebody who's overcome and accomplished so much in his life, this one is one of the sterling examples. Somebody that, as far as I know, God hasn't worked with him, but he certainly has accomplished a lot in his life. He's a member of what is called the Irish Tenors. I guess they've got a bunch of different groups now. They've got the Welsh Tenors. Maybe they've got the English Tenors. This individual's name was Ronan Tynan, and he was one of a group of four called the Irish Tenor. So he had a beautiful singing voice. In fact, back in 2001, after 9/11, when they decided to still conduct the World Series, he sang "God Bless America" at Yankee Stadium during the World Series. They did it in that year. They did it before every game, which was a little bit more unusual, but he had a beautiful singing voice. He's been profiled on a number of TV shows, but what makes him so special is that as a young boy growing up, very, very young, both of his legs had some kind of disease, and they couldn't do anything but amputate both of his legs. And they amputated both of his legs at age 20. Well, Dr. Ronan Tynan went on to become an orthopedic surgeon in his life. He went to college, went to medical school, became a physician, and between the years of 1981 and 1984, he competed in the Paralympics, Olympics that are staged for people who have disabilities. He set 18 Paralympic records in 4 years. 14 of them, which he still holds. When he was 33 years old, That's when he became interested in singing. So after he'd gone to college, medical school, he decided, just take up singing. He became one of the founding members of the Irish Tenors. He is one of the most sought-after, inspirational speakers in the United States. I don't know what my company paid him to speak to us, but it was thrilling to see what this individual, with all the odds against him, had overcome in his life. I had a friend of mine afterwards. We looked at each other and we were in such disbelief after hearing what he had done and the introduction by somebody else who was close to him, what he had accomplished. And then he talked about, he gave his little speech, probably 20 minutes long, whatever, told us, and it was very inspirational. I mean, for salespeople, it, you know, was a really special time. I remember one of my friends looking over at me when he sat down to the thunderous applause, and after it all died down, he looked at me and says, "What have I accomplished with my life?" Almost nothing by comparison. But one of the things that I think was most important for me to hear, and I'll share it with you because I think it is something that all of us can do, every single person here, because we know this, that when we get our minds off of ourselves and on to helping other people, good things happen. Well, he told the audience that he had had a mentor in his life that provided inspiration to him. He said a mentor can provide a legion of difference. And this one thing we do know: good examples can be very powerful. The effects of sin, we concentrate on that during the days of unleavened bread, and its powerful effects. And obviously, for effect, I wanted to concentrate on that in the introduction of the sermon today. And remember, because obviously you've got to cover sin, and you've got to explain sin in sermons, and especially around this time of year, as we look forward to the days of unleavened bread, we have to see the power of sin. But the power of a positive example can be very, very important, and actually they become difference makers in people's lives. Each of you have a sphere of influence that you're responsible for. You have family, you have friends, and you have coworkers. And the one thing about being a mentor, or let's say a positive example, is that nobody ordains you to it. Nobody appoints you to do this. It's just something that you do. And it's something that you should do as a Christian. Now, I'm not talking about taking over. I'm not talking about being an authority figure. I'm not talking about any of that. I'm talking about being a servant. No one appoints you to the title of mentor, but it's a role that you assume anytime you're ready to assume it. Romans chapter 8 and verse 33, and I'll include this in case someone thinks, "Me? What do I have to offer?" Well, you've got a lot to offer. Romans chapter 8 and verse 33, go into the days of unleavened bread, go through the process of examination, because we're told to do that at this time of year and prepare. One of the things we do is we put leaven out of our homes because we know that leaven is a type of sin and is representative of sin, and we want to do that. But then as we're doing that process, we are, and we should be, reminded of the sin that is present in our own lives, because it's still there. It's always going to be there. And, of course, when it's repented of and forgiven, it's not there any longer. But Paul said something very important here in Romans 8:33. In case you think you can't exert positive influence and positive power to somebody, who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. And that is one of the most powerful, moving passages in a very short and pithy way, in a very direct way, that nobody can lay a charge against you as a member of God's elect. Nobody. Because God has justified. Well, ancient Egypt had its influence on God's people, and it can be very instructive. It can be very helpful in understanding the power and the influence of sin in our lives. And obviously, these examples and many of others are instructive to our faith. But there is a greater power in righteousness. There is a greater power in a good and righteous example. There is a great power in being a mentor, saying a kind word, being a good example. So we often leave the days of unleavened bread with greater resolve to overcome sin, to overcome the enduring power of all that Egypt represents in the Bible. Whether you know it or not, you are a mentor. Who? Me? Yes, you. You are a mentor. And what a powerful tool you can be with your lifelong commitment to sincerity and truth.